wow, this one opportunity that we really love emotionally is not scoring as well as something else that we walked away from. You know, yeah. Why is that?
Welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Since 2007, Quiet Light Brokerage has been helping thousands of online entrepreneurs realize their dream of buying and selling online businesses. And now, we're bringing all the knowledge our team has acquired straight to you. No matter your niche or industry, these lessons, tips, and strategies will help you build, grow, acquire, or sell your online businesses better. And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Doing great, Mark. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. It's been really busy at Quiet Light the past few, weeks. This has been one of the busiest first quarters I can remember.
I know. Good problems.
Definitely good problems. So you talked to Kevin Peterson, and you and I both know Kevin from Rhodium Group. And if people aren't familiar with Rhodium, feel free to reach out to us. It's a really awesome group of entrepreneurs who are interested in the buying and selling process of online businesses. But he gave a presentation a few years ago at Rhodium. Is that right?
He did. And then Kevin and I got reconnected last October at Rhodium. And we talked about his business now, which is building a portfolio of SaaS companies. It's called Webfolio Management, and he takes other people's money and his own money and buys SaaS companies and manages them for them. And instead of people investing their own money and managing the business themselves, it's a good, you know, portfolio for people to look at and invest in. And some of his processes can be applied to anyone buying multiple businesses or a single business. And some of them are really, really critical. One allows you to measure different businesses against each other without emotions. You don't fall in love with the product. You look at the statistics. So that, and there'll be a link in the show notes available to a sample template tool for that. And the other thing that he does, which is really critical, Mark, is clean financials for each individual SaaS business that they purchase. They segment them out. They have work orders for each. So anytime he wants to exit, it's clean. And he talks in detail about how to do that, which is really, really important.
Awesome. Well, this idea of building a portfolio business is something I hear buyers ask about frequently. A lot of people want to know how to go about doing that, whether or not it's feasible. And I think you and I have only seen this really pop up probably within the last 2 or 3 years, where we're seeing more and more of these portfolio businesses like Kevin's pop up.
Yeah, I've seen it a few times, and the ones that I've seen generally are really hard to exit one of the assets of the portfolio because everything is commingled. And that's a challenge, right? You're either going to sell it all, or you're going to try to sell, you know, one asset. And it's really hard on the books when you do that. And you know that one of the five pillars of maximum value is clean financials. We've added five now, right? Planning is the fifth one.
Yeah, you keep putting that one in. I'm not sure if I'm adopting it fully, but we'll go with it.
Come on, you make more money when you plan your exit than when you wake up and say,
it's
okay,
I'm totally important. I'm just giving you grief.
I know. My job to take grief from you now.
I'm being a jackass.
There you go. That's two shows in a row. All right. So it's a great process that he has, and it's really important that if you're going to build a portfolio of sites, that you follow this because it allows you to say, okay, I'm done with this one. Let's move on, get some capital with very few headaches. So I really liked it a lot.
Awesome. Well, let's get into it.
Kevin Peterson, welcome to the Quiet Light Podcast. How are you?
Real well. Thanks, Joe. Good to be here.
Good to see you, man. Hey, listen, I mentioned it before, but we've gotten into this habit. We don't do fancy introductions. We love people like you, experts in the field, to tell us your background instead of us telling folks all about you and reading from LinkedIn profile. So for the listening audience, can you give everybody a little bit of background on yourself, what your history is like, and what you do today?
Sure. So I'm operating Webfolio Management, and it's a private equity firm that is buying small software companies. So that's when I say small software companies, that's kind of a fancy way of just saying SaaS. You know, we're working with developers around the world who are bringing new products to market. And, you know, once they're past the point of proof of concept, then that's the time where we get involved. And my background is marketing. So I've been doing marketing for 25 years, and I launched Webfolio about 4 years ago when I discovered this thriving secondary market for online businesses.
Excellent, excellent. So for Webfolio Management, do you have a broader like thesis or plan in terms of your approach to buying these businesses?
Yeah, so 4 years ago when I discovered this marketplace, I was willing to look at just about anything. You know, there was a period of time there where I had shiny penny syndrome and I was looking at everything, content sites, e-com, some SaaS, but it was really an opportunity for me to look at several different business models, look under the hood, gain an understanding of how traffic flows through a business, how money flows through a business. You know, what are the levers that you can pull to influence the direction of the business and growth? And then over the past 3 years, we've really refined our model to really hone in on just SaaS. And there are pros and cons for each type of business or each business model. SaaS is right for us because, you know, we're placing investor money. And it's a lot easier to build a story or tell a story around a SaaS business that has recurring revenue and some stable history of earnings. And it's a, you know, SaaS businesses are typically businesses that you can model. You can model the past, you can model the future. You know, you can execute a plan, you know, build a plan around growth and execute a plan based on what you know about the audience profile and how traffic and earnings are flowing through the business. And you can do that in such a way that is a little more challenging on an e-commerce business or a content site. So I have nothing against e-commerce or content sites. You know, I would feel comfortable putting my own money into a content site, but it's a little more, the risk profile is a little different for investors.
Well, that's good though. You picked your path and you're sticking to it. So there's plenty of investors to buy SaaS products. It's a great niche. I know that when I list a SaaS business, it's the multiples are always higher and it's B2B recurring revenues and the buyers come out of the woodwork. So it's a good space to be in. Can you tell those folks listening how you got started with this? I know you said you started 4 years ago, but did you put your own money in? Did you have somebody approach you and say, hey, look, I love what you do. I want to give you a whole bunch of money. How'd you get started in case somebody else wants to try to do it themselves?
Yeah. So this actually, Webfolio started over a lunch conversation with a colleague of mine, fellow entrepreneur. It's not uncommon for me to meet with fellow entrepreneurs on a pretty regular basis and talk about different ideas that we have. It's an opportunity for us to poke holes in each other's ideas. There's no shortage of ideas in the world. Not all of them are worth executing. Even those that are worth executing, not all those are easy to execute. So there's, you know, barrier to entry is certainly a consideration. So 4 years ago, I was having lunch with a colleague and we were talking about building a model where what we were proposing to do was launch basically an appraisal company for web-based businesses. And at the time, we really didn't have much, like you know, most people, we didn't really have any awareness of the space. We didn't realize that there was a thriving secondary market for web-based businesses. So it wasn't until, you know, we had this launch and we kicked around ideas around, you know, how could we appraise, you know, do appraisals for online businesses and help sellers, you know, prep for sale. We weren't really talking, you know, in a lot of detail about brokerage per se, but we were talking about just, you know, the appraisal piece, appraising businesses and coaching sellers. And once we started researching that concept, that's when we stumbled upon this space and realized that, wow, there's, you know, these transactions are occurring all the time. There's a community that is looking at these businesses and the deals and funding the deals and brokering the deals. And so that's how we started. And the very first website that I purchased for myself was it was actually a tattoo blog that I bought on Flippa. The business was throwing off about $300 a month, pure AdSense revenue.
Big spender.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I paid about $900 for it. So I was excited because wow, it was basically like a three month.
That's a great multiple.
Yeah, exactly.
And how long before it started, stopped getting traffic and went out of business?
Well, it was quite the opposite. So the funny thing was, you know, I looked at that business and I was like, hey, you know, I'm willing to invest in my education. I want to get started somewhere. And I don't have any tattoos, but I liked the blog. The blog was actually pretty cool. And when I took it over, the first thing I did was I hired a developer to make it mobile friendly. At this time, you know, 4 years, it sounds strange today, but just 4 years ago, most websites were not mobile friendly yet.
Right.
I mean, that transition or that evolution has really only occurred within the past couple of years. Right. Where now it's very, you know, now it's it's the norm. It's a given. But, you know, just 4 or 5 years ago, that was a little strange. So I paid a developer $300 to make it mobile friendly, make some changes to the site. And then I started writing the blogs myself, even though I don't have any tattoos. But I, you know, I understood, and partly based on my marketing background, I understood that relevance is everything when you're driving traffic. So I started writing blog posts tying tattoo designs to holidays. So like if Halloween was coming up, I would write a, you know, here's the history of Halloween, and here are a bunch of Halloween related tattoos, right?
Yeah.
And traffic shot up and revenue went up. So, you know, this site that I had invested a total of $1,200 in was quickly earning about $750 a month in AdSense revenue.
Wow, fantastic.
Yeah. So for me, the light went on and I was like, hey, if I can do that with one site, what if I had 10 or what if I had 100, right? I should buy them all.
Yes.
and then of course, what happens over time, and I know a lot of people, a lot of my colleagues have experienced this as well, where over time you realize that, well, actually running a $10,000 site is not 10 times harder than running a $1,000 site.
That's correct.
And running $1 million site is not.
It's often easier because you've got systems and procedures in place, and it's less work often.
That's exactly right. So for the past 4 years, I've been stair-stepping Webfolio. So the acquisition targets have been getting larger and larger. And it's all about efficiency of scale. And just like you said, and now we're taking another step forward where we're realizing that there's actually a threshold where businesses are throwing off enough cash that you can really invest in traditional infrastructure, right? Traditional sales and marketing people, tactics, and you have more runway, and you can really have some, CapEx that drives growth.
So you went from 0.25 multiple, by the way, I did the math on it when you add in the developer. and now you're focused on SaaS. How many you've went from zero to how many in your portfolio now that you operate?
There's about a dozen.
About a dozen. Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not too bad of a growth. That's manageable over 4 years. I guess that's once a quarter or so.
Yeah. And that discounts some very small, micro businesses like the tattoo blog that I purchased in the early days that, there were some that never earned a dime or only earned a dime, so we've been stair-stepping the business and narrowing our focus.
And your focus is now SaaS. You've gone from tattoos to software as a service B2B. It's an interesting transition. Tell me about the remote staff or in-house staff. You've got a dozen businesses, or you got the same people all working on it, or how's it working?
So it's a little bit of both, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some growth through acquisition where we retain talent where it makes sense to do so, and and we're retaining some mind share, and we try to retain some resident experts wherever possible, but we also at the same time centralize as much as we can as well. So we've got a dev team in the Ukraine. We've got service people in the Philippines. We have sales staff in Canada. And then, I've been doing marketing for 20 some odd years. And my marketing team here in the US still does a lot of the heavy lifting on the marketing side.
Okay. As far as the process of buying something, like what do you do when you look at a site? What is your process in terms of vetting the site and what kind of deal structure you're looking at? You've bought many now. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting piece that I really wanted to share, which is, and I've had a few coaching clients over the years. One of the areas that I've really focused on with new people in this space who are just getting started, or maybe they bought one or two, they've had one or two acquisitions and they're still kind of finding their direction. One of the things that I really focus on with people is, you have to have a very clearly defined direction or a very, very clearly defined criteria for what makes a good deal for you. Because especially for entrepreneurs, we all have shiny penny syndrome to some extent, right? And, it's very easy to look at every deal that comes through as a great deal. And it's just not the case, right? And not even good deals, not every good deal is right for everyone, right? So
what's the first thing you look at? A lot of folks will just say, the first thing I look at is the multiple, which I think is a mistake in many ways. What's the first thing you look at when you're obviously SaaS?
Yeah.
Second thing, I guess.
So we actually have an acquisition scoring model. And I would encourage everybody to do this, even if you're building an acquisition scoring model that is based on just like 5 criteria or 8 criteria or something, right? Like ours is 20 or 23. There's like 20 or 23 criteria that we run every acquisition target through to say, you know, and part of that process is taking the emotion out of it, applying some metrics to it, putting a little science behind it so that we can, we can kind of get out of the way of ourselves, so we're not our own worst enemy, right? So the idea is that when we run something through the scoring model, you know, it's going to produce a score for that acquisition target. And it's a way for us to assess one opportunity against another. And we do, you know, by applying some methodology there, we do occasionally surprise ourselves where we'll say, wow, this one opportunity that we really love emotionally is not scoring as well as something else that we walked away from. You know, Why is that? So having some, you know, it gets back to just defining criteria for what you're looking for and what you're comfortable with.
That's
so
excellent.
For us, the conversation starts at B2B SaaS. So is it B2B SaaS? We will look at some B2B, B2C blend. We'll look at some SaaS service blend. But the conversation always starts with, you know, is it B2B SaaS? Is there a recurring revenue component? Has it been in business for at least, you know, X number of months or years, right? And then from there, we look at other things like, what is the marketplace look like? Are there a lot of competitors? What's the barrier to entry for new competitors? I'm not going to give you all the details of our scoring model, but anybody can do this, right? Anybody who's looking at buying businesses can produce, you know, at least, even if you're just doing it on an Excel sheet and you have 7 criteria that are really important to you,
right?
Figure out what those important criteria are and document it and run every single opportunity against that model to say, do I just love it? Or,
right.
Or is it actually right for me? Because there's a difference. It's easy. And, you know, for me, even today, I look at businesses all the time that where I love the business model and I have a lot of respect for the founders or the sellers. I'm like, wow, that's a great idea. I can see why that is doing well. I can see why that's making money. I can see why that's a good opportunity for someone. It's not right for me, but it's a good model. It's a good business.
Okay. So emotion, get emotion out of the way, use math and logic, your scoring model, and the right ones will rise to the surface. How many you look at on a monthly or quarterly basis?
I probably look at, so I get emails from, you know, brokers and developers in our network almost every day.
Okay.
And I probably look at 2 or 3 per week that are interesting to some extent. We probably vet 2 or 3 per month and really, really look under the hood on maybe 1 or 2 a month in total. Okay.
So not too many then, probably 30 or 40 a year. Tell me about... Correct. What you're building a portfolio of businesses here, really. Some at some point or another, every time I see somebody that does what you're doing, at some point or another, they think, okay, this one is no longer an exact fit for our model, or it's matured enough that we want to take it off the table and get some equity, get some cash for it. Do you set up separate LLCs or corporations for each purchase that you make, or do you commingle the funds?
It depends on the situation. So, when I started 4 years ago, my vision was there would be a separate LLC for each fund, and there would be maybe 2 or 3 or 4 assets in each fund. But what I'm finding over time is that we really are spinning off a separate LLC for each entity. And especially as our businesses are getting bigger, it's, you know, if you've got 3 businesses that are in a related space or in a single vertical that are relatively small, then putting them into a single LLC is not that big a deal. But at some point, if you really want to package things for eventual sale, I mean, really, so that's something else I learned over the years, the money's in the exit, right?
It is.
So if you really want to package things for sale, you need to think about the sale on the day of your acquisition, right? So don't wait year or 2 years or 5 years to get your books in order and package it up for sale. You really need to be thinking about the exit on the day that you buy it.
It's almost the least fun thing to think about, right? Yes. In terms of getting your financials in good shape. But like you said, the money's in the exit, and the better job you do at managing that separate LLC, the easier it's going to be upon the exit. Because when you go to a broker, they say, all right, well, give me a profit and loss statement for the last 36 months with a monthly view in a single tab in Excel. Easy to run. If you commingle with others and you're only selling one, for everybody listening, it's really difficult to separate them out because you're commingling expenses and staff and things of that nature.
Yep.
And the buyers lose some confidence in the accuracy of the financials, and that'll pull the value down because it brings the risk up a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, another logistical piece that'll add to that is we call them SOWs, statement of work documents. Okay. Where when we have resources on our team that are managing projects for multiple assets, nothing gets, there's no budget that gets approved and invoices don't get paid until there's a statement of work document for that project for that asset. So that way we've got a paper trail on expenses that tie a single worker's time to fractional allocation by asset. Did that make sense?
It's the absolute
marketing accounting gibberish, but
it's the absolute right way to do it. Basically, you're having a remote contractor, somebody that might be consistent
on
five different projects. Yes. Maybe they're an employee, but they're billing each B2B SaaS company for the work that they do.
That's exactly right.
2 hours.
In large companies, they often refer to those as a glide, right? In the accounting world. It really is a glide from one group within an organization to another, or one entity. If you've got a huge conglomerate that has multiple brands, they may glide funds back and forth between entities that are wholly owned by one umbrella.
Right.
Again, I know I'm getting into the weeds a little bit, but it just makes sense to do that. And then for me, at the end of the day, it comes down to sort of defending those expenses at time of sale, right? So that when somebody's looking and they're like, hey, this one person is, being paid for seven different projects. How does that work? If somebody really digs deep, then we can say, well, here are the projects they worked on. And we approved the hours and the project and forecast, ROI or KPIs or whatever before the work began. And this is what we did, and this is what happened. So.
And every seller should expect the buyer to dig deep. Whether it's a million, a million, 2 million, 5 million, they've worked hard for that money. They're not going to spend it lightly, and they may hire somebody like Chris at Centurica to do the due diligence.
Yeah, exactly. I do.
A lot of clients do. I think it's a smart thing. So I love the scoring model. Fantastic. Great advice. Statement of work when you've got multiple people working on different projects, or one person working on multiple projects. And the separate LLCs, more important than anything else, guys, separate LLCs for each entity within the portfolio. Let's talk about deal structure, because everybody's probably wondering how you do this. When you make an offer on something, talk fictitious numbers, but what is this typical deal structure, if there is such a thing, with you?
Yeah, so there are probably a few typical scenarios, right? And to me, it always starts with the seller's goal. It's very important to understand what the seller is trying to get out of the deal before you even start the conversation. If you understand their motivation, then you can craft a winning LOI, because you're answering their pain points.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that you're giving up, you're not giving up the farm. You don't want to shoot yourself in the foot, right? But if you at least know that you're answering some of the seller's key objectives, it's a lot easier to get a winning bid in. And so what I mean by that is, like, if there are multiple partners on the seller side, you need to understand, like, who's looking for cash, who just wants out, who might want to stay with the business. Is there anyone that wants to stay on and retain some equity? You need to understand, the dynamic there as well. Like, if they're you know, every seller is different and every business is different. Absolutely. So there are some sellers where they're like, oh man, I can carry a note or I can't carry a note, right? I need the cash out or I don't need the cash out, or this is super urgent or it's not so urgent, right? There are some sellers who are emotionally attached to their businesses. There are others who are completely not, right? There's just a commodity for them. They're like, hey, I have this idea. I my goal is, and I've heard this story. This is a real example. I can't tell you the business, but you know, a real example was a seller who said, you know, I had this idea and I'm a developer. So I started this thing and my goal was if I could get to $6,000 a month in income, I would be thrilled. And then 12 months later, I had $60,000 a month in income and I couldn't believe it. And, so the business is awesome. I never expected it to go this far. I also recognize I'm not the guy to take it to the next step. So I'm ready to sell it, right?
It really happens. And for those that haven't made those types of purchases, those people are out there. It's not their skill set and they're not enjoying it anymore, which is strange, right? My goal was 6,000 a month. Now I'm making 60, but you know what? It's no fun. I want out. It's all the time. So you really, you're trying to really hone in on what the seller's goals are, what their pain points are, and seeing if you can meet those pain points. I would imagine that just based upon our conversations here and meeting out at Rhodium a couple of times, you do the best you can to make a good impression and have them like you and feel good about you and trust you as well, right?
Yeah, that actually matters. That matters more than most buyers realize. Right. I have won a couple deals where the sellers took our offer over a higher priced offer because I don't want to say it's just because they liked me. That was probably a piece of it, but it's more than that. I mean, you know, one of the advantages that we have is that we have infrastructure. So it's easy for me to sell to a seller based on our infrastructure. And what I mean by that is, you know, we can share a vision for growth at the time of the seller call. And that actually carries a lot of weight. And that's actually, I hadn't really articulated that before, but that's actually an important point for buyers in your network, where if you've done a little bit of homework, and you should before you go into a seller call, if you've done a little bit of homework about how you would grow that brand, what are you going to do to take it to the next level? If you can articulate that during the seller call, you're much more likely to get picked if there are multiple offers. And the reason is sellers, whether they're really emotionally attached to their brand or not, they all want to see the brand do well post sale. I mean, I shouldn't say all, but there are a few rare exceptions where, you know, the seller is like, I just want out and I just want to be done with it. I don't care what happens to it. But in my experience, that's unusual. Most sellers, even though they're selling, they want to see the brand do well post sale. Okay. So if you can go into that seller call and say, hey, you need to be a little careful because you don't want to give them a lot of new ideas and talk them into keeping their business and executing your plan, right? But if you can at least go into the seller call and say, hey, you know, I really love what you've done so far. It's really cool. And because of my infrastructure and my background and some of the people on my team, we can take it to the next level and we have some ideas. And here's one of the ideas that we would, and have you ever thought about this? Have you ever tried that? The more you can have that conversation on the seller call, the more likely you are to make an impression on the seller that says, hey, these guys actually care. They actually care about the brand. It's not just a transaction. And they have a vision for where to take it next. And it just comes down to execution, right? Like these guys have some level of infrastructure and experience and resources that I don't have, and they can take it to the next level. And I want to see that happen. So.
Yeah, I find it's critically important when you have that type of conversation with a seller, because even though they're selling, even though they're emotionally done and ready to move on to their next adventure, they want to look back and point to it and say, you know what, I sold that. Look how well it's doing.
That's right.
And it makes them proud. This might be stating the obvious, but I'm going to ask you, how important is your LinkedIn profile? How important is the Webfolio Management website to these calls? Because people, I tell you what, I always share that detail for a conference call. The seller gets to look at a LinkedIn profile, things of that nature. Do you find people do some research on you prior to a call with them as well?
They absolutely do. The surprising piece, the LinkedIn piece doesn't really surprise me. And I'll just be fully transparent. Our Webfolio site, it has taken a lot of time and thought to get it to where it is today. it was surprising to me how it was kind of painful determining what the right messaging is for our own website. I know that sounds ridiculous because we're buying businesses, but what you're saying is absolutely true, that it's actually critically important to have your profile online, wherever that lives, conveying the message that you want to convey. And so
it kind of wraps up your initial, thesis with a plan.
You're
putting a message out there. You want to look at those details as well. I've actually had guys come to me that are selling their businesses. And when the email comes through, on Gmail, sometimes it has the photo there where they're, at the beach topless with the beer in their hand. And so you're selling a multi-million dollar business.
Right.
I mean, good for them, right?
Yeah.
Most people want to live that lifestyle, but when you're selling a multi-million dollar business, put a shirt on.
Yeah. So I've been surprised at how many people I've met with who have said they've listened to podcasts that I've been on. That's been the one surprise for me. Like, I'm not surprised when someone says they've seen my LinkedIn profile, or they actually send me a LinkedIn request before our seller call.
Yeah.
But I've been surprised how many calls I've been on where they're like, oh yeah, I heard you on this podcast 2 years ago or 3 years ago. I just was on a call 2 days ago. Somebody said they heard a podcast from 4 years ago.
Wow.
I was like, wow.
People listen to podcasts. That's for
sure.
Yes,
they do.
They're listening right now, hopefully.
Yes.
Well, hey, listen, we've got the idea of having a thesis and a plan, wrapping that back up in your personal LinkedIn profile, things of that nature. Deal structure really varies depending upon the deal. Focus on what the pain points are for the seller, right? Be likable and you're going to get a better deal. I think you're right. I've seen people get better deals because the seller flat out likes them more. They connected with them and they said, taking care of the customers and the remote staff are my top priority. I've seen somebody beat an all cash deal at the same price in that scenario, right, where the seller took a several hundred thousand dollar seller note over an all cash deal at the same full cash price. And then, a lot of details in there. The one thing that we didn't talk about much, and we're kind of running short on time, but I want to touch on it. You mentioned Chris at Centurica, or said you use them. You didn't say Chris, it's Yates. For your due diligence, you've probably got your own team, but you also hire out to guys like Chris Yates at Centurica for the due diligence process?
Yeah, we absolutely do. And typically we bring Centurica in after we've done our own due diligence. So at the point, when we reach the point where we're pretty comfortable with what we've seen, and typically after we're past LOI, so for us, it's like we do our own assessment and we run a business through our scoring model. We determine if it's something we really want to pursue, and then we go to LOI, and then we do some high level due diligence. And then before we get into a deep dive, that's when I usually bring in Centurica to take a look at it. And what we're looking for from Centurica, for us anyway, is we're looking to them to find things that we might have missed, right? And there is another dynamic there too. Since they are a third party, a lot of times sellers are more likely to open up to a third party and do screen shares on their bank accounts and so forth than they would with the direct buyer. So having a third party actually makes a difference. And so we bring them in at that point to take a look and then report back to us to say, you've seen the reports. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have seen the reports, but, they send the report back. And then from there, you can kind of pick through and say, oh, yeah, they caught this. We also caught that. And we're not that concerned about it. Oh, they caught this and we didn't catch that. That's something we need to follow up with the seller on and see if that's if it's a thing, right? Is that a deal breaker or not?
Yeah.
And really, that's what it's all about, right? You're looking for the deal breakers.
I think it's a great idea to use them. I don't care if it's an experienced buyer or a novice buyer. I want them all to use someone like Chris because it gives you that second set of eyes.
Yes.
And the reports for anybody, for any seller, don't be afraid of them because generally they're going to be ugly. But what it does, I've never had a deal fall apart because of a Centurica third-party review. It might have fallen apart for a different reason altogether, but not because of that. What the reports really do, I think, for buyers is also paints a picture of what's wrong with the business, which in turn paints a picture for past growth when you fix them.
Yes, that's right.
I think that's critical.
Yeah, and then, so for us too, bringing in, we're pooling investor capital, so I wouldn't execute a deal without getting a third party review, because I need to be able to go to my investors and say, hey, it's not just us. Like, it's not just us thinking this is a good idea. Here's a third party report that found X, Y, and Z. And so for us, it's just part of the process and we check the box.
So real quickly, before we wrap up, investor money, are you taking money from investors, from anybody listening that may not have the wherewithal to buy a $300,000, $400,000 site, but may have, you know, $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 laying around? Are you taking investors like that to build a bigger portfolio?
Yes, we are. And there's an interesting dynamic there too, which is it appears that I think all of the coaching clients I've had over the years have ended up being investors. Like they contracted me to do some coaching for them to teach them about the space. Yeah. And then once we're at like session six, they're like, hey, you know what? There's a lot more to this than I thought there was. And I just invest with you and not buy a site on my own, because what I've learned from this coaching process is that I don't actually want to operate these businesses. I just want to invest, right? I want the passive income. I want to be in the space, but I am not prepared to run one of these full time.
Right. What kind of return on investment is someone earning when they invest with you?
Typically it's in the, I'm just going to give some round numbers. It's in like 15 to 20% annual.
That's incredible, really.
It makes sense on the on B2B SaaS. A lot of these B2B SaaS businesses, at the time that we buy them, they're running between 60 and 75% net margin, which is insane. There's always some seller discretionary that could be applied in there. And for us, you know, we're willing to squeeze margins in order to favor growth. So we do invest in the growth. So I tell investors up front that, you know, we're not going to, the business is running a 72% net margin today. That's not going to, you know, we're not going to be able to maintain that.
Right.
But if we double the top line and the net margin takes a 15% haircut, you know, to buy that growth, you know, it's a win. So exactly. The point is that in a B2B SaaS, there's typically some free cash flow there that you can use to grow the business and still deliver very favorable returns.
Well, we'll put your contact information in the show notes so that anybody listening that wants to be an investor can reach out, maybe for the coaching as well, or any of the other aspects of it. Any last thoughts, any last advice for anybody that is looking to build a portfolio of online businesses? Don't do it and just invest instead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, if you're gonna jump in, be deliberate, take your time. As they say in real estate, there's always another property, you know, and even in real estate, right, there's always another view property. Mm-hmm. Not every deal is the right deal. So take your time and find the right one. So I've said this a million times in the past 3 years, but our brand is deliberate. That's the word we use to describe how we operate.
I like it. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it. I think a lot of folks are going to enjoy this. And I will see you in October at the next Rhodium event, I think, right?
Perfect. Yeah. All right, excellent.
Man. Good chatting.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Quiet Light Podcast. For more resources from this episode, head over to quietlightbrokerage.com. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a rating and review in iTunes. This helps share the messages from the show with more business owners like you.